This is The Europeans, and we are back for our latest weekly dive into stuff that's been happening around what is currently a very cold continent. This is Katie in Paris, and Dominic is away singing his little heart out. So I have, keeping me company this week, a wonderful producer in Warsaw. Hi, Wojciech.
Hi, hello.
How are things over there?
Well, it's cold. Everyone has COVID. And yeah, that's the beginning of 2025.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
I actually wanted to start this episode by congratulating you and your great nation of Poland on the start of your presidency of the EU. You guys are in charge for the next 6 months. How does it feel?
Well, it's nice to be in charge for once. I'm not sure where is this all heading. We're seeing a lot of different weird things going on with Polish government right now. The turn to the right is really drastic. And there's news coming every day that Donald Tusk said something really right-wing. Mm. And it's less and less surprising, but more and more worrying every day. But I hope that at least some of the key points of the presidency that I've seen are pretty hopeful, like removing dependency from gas import from Russia that we're going to discuss later.
Yeah.
So yeah, I hope this is going to be a good one.
I just read that your official logo for the presidency is an apple.
Oh,
does
yeah.
Poland have like particularly delicious apples? I don't think I've ever eaten a Polish apple.
My God, so I have to send you some. Yeah, so Poland has produced a lot of apples since, you know, centuries. And there was this interesting moment where we used to export a lot of apples to Russia, but they got embargoed pretty early. I think that was way before 2014. And for a short stint, the overproduction of apples was so high that you could get free apples everywhere.
Free, completely free apples.
Yeah, there were like free apples. And there was this action, eat apples to annoy Putin, where you were just supposed to buy Polish apples from Polish producers and eat them all the time just to make up for the money they lost on the embargo. But then they very quickly started exporting apples to places like Saudi Arabia and Singapore. And from what I've heard, it turned out to be way more profitable than selling it to Russians.
Oh,
you can make a big buck producing good apples in Poland, I think.
I've learned so much in this episode already. Well, I'm looking forward to trying an apple next time I come to visit you. But apples aside, we actually have some good news to share, don't we?
Oh my God, yes. The crowdfunding campaign, yes? That's what you mean.
That's what I mean.
I mean, this is massive to me. I have to admit that I was so wrong, because I was the one who didn't quite believe we could pull it off that easily. And I was kind of reluctant to ask people for even more support, being already very grateful for everything they do for us. But since the very beginning, the enthusiasm around it was just like nothing short of amazing.
If you don't know what Wojciech's talking about, since late last year, we have been trying to raise 15,000 euros in order to fund this new series that we're making called Who Does It Best? It's a series that's going to explore which country in Europe has the best policy on three big things that shape our lives. They are housing, childcare, and drugs. And during the past week, we met our target. Hooray! So we just want to say a huge thank you to the many, many people who have donated to make this series possible, including the mystery couple who, on top of the 15,000 euros, have gifted us an incredible 8,000 euros personally to help fund this series. This kind of journalism that we want to do is very rigorous and very expensive. And it's very, very exciting. This is the first series that we've ever made that's going to be 100% crowdfunded. You, our listeners, are our bosses. So we're not only going to be making some very cool episodes, but we're also going to be sharing loads of the process of making it that we maybe wouldn't normally. And we can't wait to get started. But we should probably get on with this week's podcast. Wojciech, what are we talking about this week?
So later in the show, we'll be joined by someone who's brimming with energy to talk about European energy issues. So today's episode is sponsored by the word energy. We had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Szymon Kardas, one of Europe's leading experts on energy and climate policy, and we are to discuss the shutting down of the gas pipeline that, believe it or not, has still been sending Russian gas to some European countries across Ukraine, despite the full-blown war.
That is coming up after Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Wojciech, who has had a bad week?
I'm giving a bad week to the Serbian president Aleksandar Vučić and his party SNS.
Vučić, this is someone that you are, can I say, a little bit obsessed with? Is that fair?
Yeah, I guess. it's true, I've been pretty obsessed with Serbia for a few years now. However, I looked it up, and the last time we dedicated a proper segment of the show to Serbia was way back in the summer of 2020. Would you believe that?
Was it really?
Yeah, there's a lot to catch up on.
Okay, go for it then. Tell us what's been happening.
Okay, just to set the scene, Serbia might be quietly leading the rankings of European countries with democracy backsliding problems. Since 2012, the Serbian Progressive Party, SNS, Srpska napredna stranka, has been in government. And since 2014, it's been the absolutely dominant force, with Aleksandar Vučić calling the shots. First as prime minister and since 2017 as president.
Okay, so Serbia has been more or less under a decade under Vučić and the SNS. Give us a quick recap. Why have these dudes been so bad for Serbian democracy?
Oh, a quick recap is not possible. I'll try to make it as short as possible. So, Vučić has managed to consolidate an immense amount of power in Serbia. You could say the state is practically synonymous with the president and the party. They control almost all public institutions, media, judiciary, police, public subsidies, you name it. While preparing for this bad week, I called my Serbian friend and he told me it's impossible to overstate just how deeply Vučić and his party have infiltrated every cell of Serbian society and the economy. For example, they control an absurd number of jobs in Serbia, not just the public ones, but private ones too. This gives them massive leverage every time an election rolls around. There's even a saying in Serbia, one job equals five votes. Basically, if someone has a stable job thanks to SNS, they'll almost certainly convince their whole family to vote for SNS or for Vučić himself out of fear of losing their financial stability.
It sounds a bit like Georgia, that situation between the party and the control of jobs that we talked about on the show at the end of last year.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I've heard that Bijina Ivanishvili basically made Georgia his private enterprise, and this is somewhat what I see in Serbia. It's very, very similar. So because of this elections being very far from offering any kind of level playing field, Vučić actually loves elections. Knowing he's practically unbeatable, he uses them to legitimize his power whenever there's a significant political crisis. So this is just one example, but wherever you turn in Serbia, there's the party. If you're with them, you're fine. But if you're against them, you're in trouble. Your career, education, even your safety could be at risk. It's a very elaborate example of what we call state capture, where all the mechanisms that democracies use to ensure balance and justice are completely tilted to play into one party's interests.
Okay, pretty bleak. But there does seem to be some maybe very tentative sign of some change. I presume you're giving a bad week to Vučić because there have been these protests rocking the country, right?
Yes, Serbs are protesting again. They've protested many times before, especially over the last 2 to 3 years. But this time, I would say it feels a bit different.
That's interesting because I remember there were these protests last year that led to this rerun of local elections in the capital, Belgrade. But that kind of flopped, that movement, right? Like the opposition just ended up fragmenting at the last minute. They had all of these internal fights and then they lost quite badly. What is different this time?
First of all, the cause of the protests is different. On November 1st, 2024, a concrete canopy at the railway station Novi Sad, the second biggest city in Serbia, collapsed, killing 15 people.
A concrete canopy, so like a, I'm trying to imagine it, like a big concrete bridge almost?
It was more like a half of a roof that was overhanging from the front of the railway station, giving people shelter from sun or rain. So what's crucial here is that this was a station that had been just fully renovated as a part of one of the SNS's flagship projects, building a high-speed train line between Belgrade and Budapest. Even more importantly, Vučić's popularity, which helped him win consecutive elections before tightening his grip on every aspect of the country, was built on this image of a politician who put an end to the misery of the late 90s and early 2000s. He actually led Serbia out of a dramatic economic crisis, partly through ambitious public investments, just like this renovation. But today the system around him is deeply corrupt. This massive renovation, costing a whopping 65 million euros, was declared fully complete and opened last March with great fanfare, long before all the necessary final inspections were conducted. Several local and national politicians cut the ribbon and bask in the glory of this new, shiny public transport hub in Novi Sad.
You said it was open last March. There was an election last March. Is there any suggestion that the officials rushed the opening of this big, shiny new station because there was an election coming and they thought it would make them look good?
Yeah, of course they did. And then they closed the station down immediately after the election to reopen it again with another big ceremony in July 2024. 3 months later, the disaster struck. And this event is pivotal because until now, the unwritten social contract in Serbia was this. Vučić provided a sense of stability and economic progress. And in return, people weren't supposed to ask too many questions about how he achieved it or how much money was being embezzled along the way. All the big-time corruption scandals were being swept under the rug, and the whistleblowers or investigative journalists were much more likely to go to jail rather than high-ranking politicians involved in some monkey business. Mm. But the dynamic shattered on November 1st, when 15 people died due to a sloppy, corrupt, and clearly politically driven renovation. A lot of the posts I read on social media after the tragedy included a very pointed line, Korupcija ubija, which is Serbian for corruption kills.
And how did the politicians in Vucic's circle react to all of this?
Basically, they stuck to their usual playbook of downplaying anything unfavorable. Remember, they control almost all the media in the country, so they control the narrative too. Mm-hmm. At first, they tried to blame the canopy's original construction on communist engineers from the Josip Broz Tito era. But that fell apart quickly because you can easily see before and after photos showing how the canopy was visibly changed during the renovation. Their next move was to roll out Protocol 2, which is Vučić gives a long, aggressive TV speech, scapegoats some pawn, and tells people what they should think. He'll frame it as all being blown out of proportion by the anti-Serbian opposition, who are traitors and want Serbia wiped off the map. And I'm not joking, like, that's exactly the kind of rhetoric he uses every day. Normally, he didn't promise to punish everyone responsible, announce an investigation, and let it drag on until people forget. He tried that again this time, but I think that the sheer scale of the negligence during construction and reports of an alleged cover-up made his usual tactics less effective. It seems like people are just really angry this time.
And as for the protests themselves, I mean, you said that they are different this time. What do you mean?
Previous protests in recent years were usually centralized. These were massive marches in the biggest cities organized by some political forces. And keep in mind that almost all opposition politicians are to some extent compromised, whether through actual wrongdoings or because of brutal smear campaigns run against them 24/7 by the government. And this time, though, the protests have been decentralized. There are no clear leaders or speeches. People simply gather at 11:52 on Fridays and stay silent for 15 minutes, commemorating the 15 victims and the exact time and day of the disaster.
Wow, that's really powerful.
Yeah, and what's been also striking is how these protests have often included acts of civil disobedience. So it's blocking bridges, blocking access to the prosecutor's office, or even blocking a railway station somewhere far from Belgrade, where police aren't prepared to break up the crowd immediately. And I think this has made the regime really angry, and the protesters have been met with increasing aggression and severity. But what's even more important is that Vučić could downplay previous protests because they usually just called for his resignation. He would employ his entire propaganda machine to turn any attack against him into an attack against Serbia. But this time, the demands are different. Protesters want one very simple thing, a thorough, transparent investigation, and for those responsible to be held accountable.
I mean, that sounds pretty reasonable. Why wouldn't Vučić just put an end to this by giving the people what they've asked for?
I mean, only Vučić knows. But from the comments I've heard from experts and what I've heard from regular people, some say he might be afraid to expose the inner workings of his corrupt machine. What they've been doing behind the scenes isn't petty crime. SNS has ties to organized crime, well documented by international investigations. These are really dark, dark things. And lastly, the protests since the beginning of 2025 are students' protests. For first time in years, and on a such large scale, universities in Serbia stopped functioning. Students and academics took to the streets, forming massive crowds in Belgrade, under the third largest city, Niš. This is very symbolic because massive student protests were actually the start of the movement that led to the downfall of Slobodan Milošević, Serbia's previous infamous authoritarian president.
So this does feel a bit different, as you say, from previous opposition that we've seen to Vučić. Do you think there is any sign that this could plausibly be the beginning of the end for his rule, or is that going too far?
What I can say for sure is that last year, after the rerun of the fraudulent Belgrade local elections, when it turned into a complete clusterfuck, I spoke to several Serbs and they were completely disheartened. I heard a lot of, there's no hope, everything's lost, and there's widespread apathy in Serbian society. Hmm. Now, though, the mood among the same group of people seems much, much better, even despite the police's growing brutality. Of course, Vučić would win any election he calls, and there's no chance he's being removed anytime soon. But at least this time, even though he's downplaying the gravity of the protests, he called the students stupid and manipulated by their professors, you can feel the nervousness in his camp. And I do believe these very focused, patient and silent protests could maybe be start of a long, long road toward a more democratic and just Serbia, which is what I heartfully wish to all Serbs out there.
Yeah, a glimmer of hope indeed.
Yeah, it is a glimmer of hope, and I'll do my best to keep you updated more frequently than once in 4 years.
Please do.
So who has had a good week, Katie?
Well, this was a bit of an awkward topic change from Serbia because I've chosen something very unserious to talk about this week, but we could all do with a bit of silliness, I think. So I'm going to say it's been a good week for people who like experimenting with new recipes after a controversy in recent days over whether or not you can eat Christmas trees. Have you ever tried eating a Christmas tree, Wojciech?
Eating a Christmas tree? No, that has not come up to me.
Yeah, it's not something that has ever occurred to me either. But it turns out that you can, in specific, carefully controlled circumstances. Okay? Stay safe, everyone. This controversy started in the Belgian city of Ghent last week. Ghent is a quite proudly eco-friendly city. It brands itself, for example, as the vegetarian capital of Europe because it has more vegetarian restaurants per capita than big cities like Paris, for example. And this post-Christmas period has been no exception in terms of City Hall's well-meaning messaging. Last week, the city of Ghent launched a campaign encouraging residents to prevent waste after the festivities in various ways. For example, by inviting friends over to eat a soup or a quiche that you have made with any sad vegetables that have been languishing at the bottom of your fridge. Make some pickles, City Hall suggested on its website. Reuse your gift wrapping. And then City Hall turned its attention to the prickly question of what to do with all of the Christmas trees that people have been throwing out over the past couple of weeks. In my neighborhood here in Paris, there's a big kind of Christmas tree graveyard where you can take them. And then I think they get turned into like wood chips and spread in the parks over the soil. Apparently, it's quite good at stopping weeds from growing. And what happens in Warsaw? Do people just leave them in the street?
So I remember there was this action, I think that was 3 years ago, where they called it a Christmas tree last duty. And we were just piling trees in front of our houses. They were collected by some municipal services and then they were supposed to be burned and turned into energy.
Which
is hopefully some kind of like greener energy than the one we usually get from coal.
Yeah, we have to hope. Dominic talked in our last podcast before the holidays about the ongoing debate about the environmental impact of Christmas trees. And the eco-friendly city of Ghent is very mindful of this debate. It suggested planting the Christmas tree in your garden, if you have one, in the hope that you might be able to use it again next year, just like Dominic does. Well done, Dominic. And then the city suggested, and I quote from the website, in Scandinavia, pine needles have been used in culinary dishes for a long time. Pick the needles from branches, dip them briefly in boiling water, dry them on a cloth, and then use them for spruce needle butter. Have you ever heard of this dish, spruce needle butter?
No, not really. Also, like, I think my Christmas tree had at least like 5 kilograms of pine needles. So am I supposed to turn it into 5 kilograms of butter?
You could make a year's worth of butter for sure. I mean, there is indeed this long tradition of cooking with spruce needles in Scandinavia. You can use them to infuse in syrups or indeed butter or alcohol, like schnapps. Supposedly, the Vikings brewed spruce beer, which they thought made them more courageous in battle and also more fertile.
Now I'm interested.
Yeah, that's what you could do with your 5 kilos. Make yourself some nice beer. I actually also found recipes for spruce butter, spruce oil, and spruce vinegar by René Redzepi, the chef of the legendary and quite controversial Copenhagen restaurant Noma, one of the world's fanciest chefs. These recipes were on the New York Times website from back in 2010. But at the time, René Redzepi seemed to agree with Ghent City Hall about the environmental benefits of giving your Christmas tree a second life by cooking with it. He said, "It seems pointless simply to discard this bounty after only a few weeks of using it as ornamentation. This year, let's all butcher the tree."
Okay, so what's the problem? Why can't we just be obedient to René Redzepi and eat the trees?
Well, the problem is that the Belgian Food Safety Agency swiftly intervened after the city of Ghent made the suggestion, and they warned people not to listen to Ghent. They should not eat their Christmas trees. And this is because, as you might have guessed, the kinds of Christmas trees that a lot of us have had in our homes over the past few weeks have been commercially grown. And as such, they have often been sprayed with all kinds of chemicals, pesticides, fire retardants to make them less dangerous.
Really?
Yeah, if you think about it, they're kind of fire hazards, despite being very pretty and jolly. Even when they're not covered in chemicals, not all Christmas trees are in fact edible. Yew trees, for example, are sometimes sold as Christmas trees. And you do not want to eat one of those because they are poisonous. So the basic message from the Belgian Food Safety Agency was, abort, abort, don't listen to Ghent City Hall. This is a terrible way of recycling your Christmas tree. And funnily enough, the City Hall website has now been updated to include this warning.
Mm-hmm. So Christmas trees are like mushrooms. You have to pick the right ones. Otherwise, yes, you're in trouble.
You have to be very careful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but as far as I remember, this is a good week and you said it's a good idea to cook pine needles and eat your Christmas tree.
Well, yes, I mean, with caveats. And I've given this idea good week because there's been another plot twist. Mm-hmm. Sweden's Food Safety Agency has now got involved with this. This is truly an international story as well a very silly one. Because, of course, there is this long tradition of cooking with pine needles in Scandinavia. So my enterprising former colleagues at AFP News Agency thought to ask the Swedish food safety experts what they thought about all of this. And they spoke to a toxicologist at the Swedish Food Agency, Anneli Widenfalk, who basically told them that you kind of want to do the opposite of cooking with a used Christmas tree just after the holidays. She said that actually the Swedish tradition is to collect the needles from young Christmas tree saplings in May or June, when the needles are very small and probably haven't been treated with chemicals yet. Anyway, I guess the lesson from all of this is that we are not all lucky enough to live on the edge of a pristine Scandinavian forest where you can just pluck some pine needles and be sure that they're not covered in dangerous chemicals. You would probably want to exercise more caution with a Christmas tree that you bought at Lidl or wherever. But if you do find yourself in circumstances where you've got access to a tree that you reckon is clean, especially in May or June, feel free to go wild with your culinary experiments. And to the Scandinavians listening to this, if you grew up eating spruce-flavoured things, I'd love to hear about it and even your favourite recipes. I hear that things infused with spruce can be very tasty and fragrant. So drop us a line with those recipes, please. hello@europeanspodcast.com.
I can share something already.
Oh, yeah?
I had a beer, actually, that was spruce flavored, and it was very good, very refreshing.
Oh, the Viking beer. Did you feel more courageous in battle and more fertile?
I have not exactly been in a battle for quite some time now, but I think that would definitely push me to be the leader of a unit or something.
As we are very proud of reminding you, this little podcast of ours is very proudly independent. There is no big media company behind it. It is literally just us making this thing every week and doing our best to make a podcast that reflects life across this continent by talking to all kinds of smart people and also trying to make a podcast that is somehow journalistically rigorous and fun at the same time. We do this every week because we love it, but I'm not going to lie to you, our finances have never looked more precarious. We're hoping to have some additional funding to keep us afloat this year, but we still don't have any news on whether that's happening. So apart from the crowdfunding that we've raised through our amazing listeners to make this new series, we're pretty much funding the show at the moment via Patreon. If you don't know what that is, Patreon is a website where you can support independent creators of things that you like by sending a few bucks their way each month, however much you want. And we are tremendously grateful to everyone who does that so that we can keep the Europeans blasting into those little ears of yours every week. Now, Wojciech, famously, when you're here on the show in front of the microphone, rather than producing the podcast, you take a very deep, very weird pleasure in reading the names of our latest supporters. So are you ready to do that?
I'm always ready to do that.
Take it away.
This week, we would like to thank Andrea, Augusta, Sandra, Jerry, Victoria, and Stephen for increasing his donation. Thank you all so much.
Beautifully done. Thank you, everyone.
Okay, Katie, do you know what has been the biggest eye-opener for me thus far in 2025?
What has been the biggest eye-opener for you thus far in 2025?
The biggest eye-opener thus far in 2025 is the fact that despite Russia and Ukraine having been in a full-blown war since 2022, Ukraine has continued to transport Russian gas across its territory so that Russia could keep selling its gas to Europe.
Yeah, I have to confess, this is something that I was only quite dimly aware of until very recently, but it seems kind of crazy.
I mean, because the pipeline that goes across Poland was basically shut down, I thought that that was also the case for the Ukrainian pipeline, but it wasn't. So this pipeline was in operation for more than 50 years, and throughout this time, it helped pump billions of cubic meters of so-called cheap Russian gas into Europe, helping economies of countries such as Germany, Italy, Austria, or France grow exponentially.
Very convenient for everyone. But how come this carried on even after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022?
Basically, it turns out that it was a contract that dated from before 2022, and simply everyone made money out of it. So we just carried on with the situation, even though it's completely weird. Mm. Also, some European recipients of this gas put a lot of pressure on Ukraine to continue the deal, to prolong their time to look for other gas sources.
Okay, makes sense, I guess.
Yeah. However, the deal expired on January 1st, and Ukraine cut off the pipeline, saying it couldn't carry on taking this blood money for transporting Russian gas while Moscow is continuing to kill its people.
That also makes sense.
Some European leaders, though, I think you'll easily guess which ones, decided to make a huge fuss about it. But is it really such a big deal? And what does it mean for Europe's energy security? Who's affected? How well is Europe doing in actually freeing itself from its dependency on Russian energy? We had the privilege of asking all these questions to Dr. Szymon Kardas.
We did. Szymon is a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He's also an assistant professor at the University of Warsaw. But above all, he is someone who speaks about the Russian-European energy landscape with unmatched enthusiasm and energy. Have we made that joke too many times? We gave him a ring in Warsaw. Szymon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure.
Let's start from the hysterical reactions to this pipeline closing from some of Europe's leaders, namely people like Slovakia's president Robert Fico, Hungary's leader Viktor Orban, or Austrian right-wing politicians who are most probably coming into power soon. Were they really that unprepared for this?
First of all, the termination of the transit deal was expected. I mean, the position of Kyiv was quite clear in 2024 that they are not interested in extending the deal with Russia. So EU member states, especially those that were still importing Russia's natural gas through Ukraine, had a pretty large amount of time, I mean, to prepare for this moment. And actually, they were doing preparations. I mean, Slovakia concluded deals related to natural gas import with Polish company Orlen, with many Western energy companies like BP. The same when it comes to Austria. In December 2023, the level of dependence on Russia's natural gas in Austria was actually extremely high. 98%. I mean, this was the level of dependence. Wow. And they were also preparing for it. They were fueling the gas storages. They even terminated the contract with Gazprom when it comes to natural gas import. And when the 1st of January 2025 came, actually, we did not observe any problems in terms of the security of supply of natural gas to countries like Slovakia and Austria. They managed quite smoothly to turn into alternative sources, and there were no disruptions and no crisis on the EU side. And Hungary, I mean, this is the most funny, actually, case, because Hungary is not getting Russia's natural gas through Ukraine anymore. According to deals that they are signed in 2021, they import Russia's natural gas mainly through the TurkStream pipeline. I mean, TurkStream, this is a pipeline that Russia constructed through the Black Sea. So in case of Hungary, those harsh statements were actually quite strange and funny to some extent, because they are not dependent on the Ukrainian route anymore.
So even though Robert Fico had warned of absolute chaos if this deal didn't continue, we largely haven't seen any of that chaos, because Europe was actually fairly well prepared for this. Everybody knew it was coming. What about the impact on the Russian economy, though? Is this a big deal for Russia? How much of their exports and how much cash have they lost as a result of this pipeline closing?
Well, according to industry sources, the natural gas that was shipped through Ukraine was estimated at $6.5 billion annually. But on the other hand, it's important to point out that revenues that were coming from natural gas export were not the most important ones. Around 80% of revenues that were coming from oil and gas in total were related to revenues from the oil sector, and around 20% from gas. But of course, I would not underestimate those billion of dollars that Russia is losing since 2022, because it was an important source of revenues for the Russian ruling elite. The elite was gaining tremendous benefits from selling natural gas to the European Union, which was actually the crucial market for Gazprom. And since they almost lost it, I believe that the elite itself is actually experiencing this loss in a more significant way than the Russian budget.
So, somehow I'm not so worried about Russian oligarchs. I think they'll be fine. However, this means that the only place really affected is Transnistria, this parastate breakaway region of Moldova, squeezed between Moldova and Ukraine. Their economy, as well as the entire energy sector, was almost entirely dependent on Russian gas imports, which they were getting for free, by the way. We've seen reports on this region being hit by a massive crisis. The industry came to a halt. There's very little gas to keep Transnistrian houses warm or even cook meals. Plus, this means that Moldova had to look for electricity elsewhere, as previously 80% of it was coming from a gas power plant in Transnistria. What's going on down there?
Transnistria was affected in the most significant way. And actually, this is a problem for Russia, because it's now Russia that needs to decide whether they want to keep this crisis situation evolving in Transnistria or provide some support for this region. And actually, they have alternative routes that they can use if they want to supply Transnistria with natural gas after the termination of the deal with Ukraine.
And is there any sign on how Russia is thinking about this, which direction they might go on? I mean, in the meantime, people in this region are freezing. It's a terrible situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, Russia has two options. One option is to keep things as they are right now, to put more pressure on the government in Moldova or maybe the EU, to put pressure on Ukraine and maybe at the end of the day force Ukraine to conclude some kind of a new transit deal through the Ukrainian territory, or simply play on the evolving crisis situation that would lead to some political problems in Moldova itself. And since we are ahead of parliamentary elections in Moldova, if this economic situation in Moldova is getting worse, that might play in favor of Russia, which is interested, clearly interested in actually having some internal turbulence in Moldova ahead of the elections, expecting that maybe some pro-Russian forces will come back to power and it will change the situation in Moldova, which Russia is clearly interested in. And the second option is that, well, Russia agrees to supply the natural gas to Transnistria using the alternative route. And this alternative route is Turkstream. The gas is there. The electricity is produced, but maybe not at the volumes that would allow Moldova to restore the mechanism that was in force previously, which might create, again, some tensions inside because Moldova would still be forced to buy electricity from the EU, which is more expensive and stuff like that. This is a big question, which scenario Russia might be interested in implementing, but we can always bet that they will use the worst scenario for us. And well, the challenge for us is to respond in a way that would neutralize their calculations.
Moving on from Moldova, something I've always wanted to ask you, given that Europe has made incredible strides in freeing itself from gas dependency since 2022, do we still import Russian natural gas on a significant scale? I know there are exceptions like Hungary and Slovakia, but overall, are we on the path to becoming entirely independent from Russian gas?
First of all, the share of Gazprom on the EU market, and when we say Gazprom, it means that we are referring to the supplies of Russia's natural gas through pipelines, decreased remarkably. I mean, their share in 2021 was more than 40%. Oh. In 2024, it's a little bit more than 10%.
Oh, yeah.
Around 10, 11. But on the other hand, what we observe at the same time is the Russian LNG.
LNG is liquefied natural gas, right?
Exactly. Liquefied natural gas that Russia is exporting using its terminal on the Yamal Peninsula from the project which is called Yamal LNG.
And just to spell this out for non-experts, the thing about this liquefied natural gas is you don't need to ship it through pipelines, right? You can transport it in other ways.
Exactly. You use the tankers to deliver this natural gas to those countries that are able to import it through their regasification terminals. The Russia's natural gas is coming nowadays to countries like France, Spain, Belgium, and some smaller volumes to some countries which are located in the southern part of the European Union.
But these are all countries which are very vocally against Russia, and their politicians are in public. What should we make of that?
This is a kind of a paradox. And the reason for that is, first of all, the long-term deals between Spanish companies and Belgian companies and French companies with Russians were concluded far ahead of the so-called full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And the main argument that those companies are using is that, well, since the import of Russia's natural gas was not sanctioned on the EU level, there is no legal basis for the termination of the deals that were concluded before the war. Mm. And there are no sanctions, and there is no consensus in the EU regarding sanctioning the import of Russia's gas. There is Russian LNG that is still coming. And actually, if we look at the preliminary data that we have for 2024, if we compare the situation in 2024 with the volumes that were coming in 2021, there is an increase. And the share of Russian LNG in EU's gas import in total increased from 3.7% in 2021 to almost 8% in 2024.
No.
And there was also an increase in terms of volumes. And this is something that we should tackle on the EU level. It would be difficult to reach a consensus among EU member states in terms of sanctions. because there is a reluctance to accept sanctioning the import of Russia's natural gas. So the other option is, first of all, to try to implement the sanctions that were already imposed when it comes to energy sector. And secondly, try to use the trade policy instruments. For instance, increase tariffs on the import of Russian natural gas. That would make it less profitable, not only for importing countries, for importing companies, but also, of course, more costly for Russia. Because the European Union actually declared politically already in 2022 that we should get rid of Russian fossil fuels by 2027. We should phase out Russian fossil fuels from the European market by 2027. It's not a legally binding goal, but still reflected on the political level. If we want to stick to it, and as far as I know, the EU institutions are interested in that, Poland, as a country which took the presidency in January 2025, is also interested in that. It's actually one of the priorities of the Polish presidency. So we should use the tools that are available to at least continue decreasing the level of our dependence, which is not high. But still, I mean, it would be good to reach the goal that we designed in 2022.
Well, apparently tariffs are back in fashion worldwide, so yeah. Maybe that's something we could do. So, turns out this whole narrative of Europe doing a great job of weaning itself off Russian fossil fuels, like, it's true to some extent, but maybe it isn't going quite as well as we thought. And that's pretty awkward.
Yeah, it feels very awkward. And I feel like this transition involves much more difficult compromises than I had thought. Something that made me a bit happier is that after the interview, I had the impression that we're not doing great on the front of trying to limit oil import from Russia. But actually, this has been dropping pretty rapidly. So maybe it's a longer process than we would wish for. But I guess we are maybe heading in the right direction, I hope.
As always with Europe, it's complicated. It is time to pull into the Inspiration Station and share a couple of things that we've been enjoying recently. Wojciech, what have you been getting stuck into?
I'll be pretty practical this time because I'd like to recommend a resource that I found very inspiring and useful throughout last year, which is the European Center for Journalism's podcast titled Journalism Innovation Podcast.
Oh, I like that show too.
Oh, it's great. Actually, I think you recommended that to me.
You're welcome.
And it's a show that discusses ideas and insights from people who are building new innovative media outlets and who try to adapt the way we do journalism to present-day reality. It's a very interesting peek behind the curtain of this industry. And I think, dear listeners, that the fact that you chose to listen to us, a very specific, not to say even peculiar, news outlet,
rude,
means you are looking for new ways of staying informed. So I guess you might be interested to hear what the biggest brains behind media transformation are up to. My recommendation is that you start listening from the most recent episode where Tara Kelly, the host, interviews a good friend of mine, Maciej Okraszewski, the creator of one of the Poland's most popular shows, Dział Zagraniczny, which is Polish for Foreign Desk. You remember Maciej, Katie?
We met and had a very nice lunch together last time I was in Warsaw.
Yeah, that's the guy. So I highly recommend the Journalism Innovation Podcast.
Yeah, it's a great show. I second this recommendation.
What have you been listening or watching, Katie?
I'm actually quite close to finish an audiobook that I've been listening to for quite a long time. I specifically listen to it while I'm walking my son to creche in the morning. So it's been taking ages to get it finished because it's a very short walk, which is very convenient, but bad for finishing this book. But I'm very nearly finished, so I figured I could cheat and recommend it this week. I wanted to recommend the book Beyond the Wall, or indeed the audiobook. And this is a really, really good history of East Germany between World War II and the reunification of the two Germanies. It's written by the historian and journalist Katja Hoyer, who is herself from East Germany. And I've been really enjoying it. It's one of those histories that mixes political and social history. So you do get an idea of the things that the leaders of the country were doing, but also what it was like for ordinary people living through these times under socialism and under this huge amount of surveillance and control. And I learned masses from this book. It was a bit of a hole in my historical knowledge, how East Germany came into existence out of World War II in the first place as a state. And it's a pretty brutal history. But I also really, really enjoyed learning about the social aspects of life in the GDR, especially things like how the state system of holidays worked, or things like how East Germany was really good at developing children's toys and became a massive exporter of them. Did you know that?
Not really. Maybe I used a lot of them when I was a kid. Like, I played with them, but nothing specific comes to mind. I remember a lot of Russian toys, but not really the ones from GDR.
You should go back through the cupboards at your parents' house and see if you can find any East German-made toys. But yeah, I learned loads of stuff from this book. So if this is the kind of history that you enjoy reading, readable history, basically, I really recommend this book. It is called Beyond the Wall, and it is by Katja Hoyer.
Sounds great.
This is a historic moment, listeners. For the first time in 7 years making this podcast, this week's happy ending comes from me.
7 years.
I've never been allowed to do it. This is Dominic's thing. But he's away, and it's a story from France this week. So, haha, I figured I could invade his segment for a change with a happy story that emerged in France actually a few weeks ago, but we're only just back after the holidays. So I'm going to share it with you now. This story comes from the little town of Thiberville, in Normandy, in northern France. The town is home to about 1,900 people, and it's a sleepy kind of place. So imagine the shock that the local mayor must have experienced when he received a phone call informing him that the town had received a donation in someone's will of nearly 11 million euros.
11 million euros?
11 million euros.
For such a small town?
Yeah. And even stranger, the money was left to the town of Thiberville in the last will and testament of someone who had the same name as the town itself. His name is Roger Thiberville. Roger lived in Paris, and as far as anyone knows, he had never visited this town that shared his name.
Oh, what a joker.
Yeah, it does seem like he did this as a kind of fun prank almost. I mean, we just don't know. He was descended from a family of vineyard owners, and he had this 10, 11 million euro fortune. He had inherited property from his parents, but he seems to have lived fairly modestly in Paris. He worked as a meteorologist, and he didn't have any family to leave his money to when he died in August at the ripe old age of 91. So he apparently seems to have just decided that a fun thing to do would be to surprise this town that shared his name by leaving them this huge amount of money.
My God, what a prankster. So like all the money he endowed, he left to this single town that he never visited, right?
Pretty much.
Jesus Christ, what a ballsy move. So now the town is loaded. What are they going to do with this money?
I mean, yeah, this is five times the town's annual budget.
No way.
This is a big deal. Jesus. The mayor, a guy called Guy Paris, he told the newspaper Le Parisien that honestly, he thought it was a hoax when he got the phone call. It just seems so unbelievable. He said that he and other town officials are going to spend some time thinking about it, but they do think they are going to pay off a loan that they used to build a new primary school a while ago. Less boringly, maybe Wojciech is putting up some solar panels around the town's balls court to create some shade and generate some energy.
Now you're talking.
And some of the money will also probably go to supporting local charities. The one thing that the town is definitely going to do is honor Roger's wishes. He left no instructions for what to do with the money. There aren't any strings attached. The one thing he said he would like is for his ashes to be put in the town cemetery. And the mayor has said, you know, this is the least we can do. So that's what they're going to do with a ceremony to honor this very, very generous surprise donation.
I think he was secretly visiting very often.
Yeah, maybe he was just a massive fan of the town.
Under some nickname, yeah.
Who knows? Oh, thanks for joining me this week, Wojciech.
Oh, my pleasure. I love joining you every time I have the opportunity to do this.
on top of producing this week's episode, along with the wonderful Morgan Child in Prague, it is always fun to have you here behind the microphone discussing Serbian politics and Scandinavian recipes.
And energy.
And energy.
Before we wrap up, I would like to give a shout out to a great Serbian film critic and author, Nikola Radic, who helped me massively in preparations for this week's segment about Serbia. Thank you so much, Nikola.
Thank you, Nikola. That's all we have time for this week. But during the week, you can find us on Blue Sky. Come and join us. It seems to be tentatively taking off as a social media platform in the post-X world. We're also on Instagram and Mastodon. Just type in the Europeans Podcast and you should find us.
Naschle.
Hejdå.